afternoon. I'm opening the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for today, April 9th, 2009. It's Senator George's birthday. I wanted everybody to be aware of that today. So when you come up to testify, it's required that you say your name and happy birthday, Senator
totally
George.
I need committee earlier then.
I want to remind everyone that any type of cell phone or PDA, if you have it on in this room, it does cause interference with our sound equipment. So if you'll please turn those off. I'm actually going to turn mine off. I usually don't bring it. So that we don't have interference during our hearing today, I would appreciate that. I am planning on taking the bills in order, the order that they're on the agenda today. We have a pretty long list, and we do plan to stay here. We have the room until 6 o'clock, but I hope we aren't here that long. Let me put it that way, and I'm sure Senator George hopes we aren't here that long as well. So I'm going to start by opening the public hearing on Senate Bill 515 and ask Lori to give us an update. This is back again.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if you remember, Senate Bill 515 deals with what are commonly known as lemon laws. And the bill is introduced. I'll briefly run through some of the things that it does. It extends the time period for the consumer to notify a manufacturer of a new vehicle that does not conform to warranty, and it specifies some of those calculations that would be at issue for a reasonable allowance for use of that vehicle. It removes the requirement that the manufacturer be given the opportunity to cure a defect, and then as you look down below, there were dash ones that the committee has looked at that made some technical revisions to the bill as introduced, and it clarified that reasonable allowance for use calculation. And it clarified some of the nonconformity provisions. There also are, on your staff measure summary, there's a reference to dash twos as well, and there is a model recreational vehicle law that is in legislative council, and we have not received the amendments that are applicable to that.
Thank you so much, Lori, and as the chief sponsor of the bill, I'll give you an update. I was hoping that we could make some progress on this bill today. However, the model RV lemon law amendment has taken a little bit longer than we expected. It's the product of a several-year work group across the country, and so our legislative council is working on putting that into an amendment that we can consider here for adoption in Oregon. With regard to the different sets of amendments, we did hear testimony on the Dash 1 amendments on April 2nd. That amendment was a result of a negotiated work group with several different members and industry and consumer advocates represented. There was a Dash 2 amendment that we had drafted that dealt with putting information, more disclosure information into the manual and at the site of the repair. It is not my intention at this time to move the Dash 2 amendments. I think that they kind of go beyond what the group had agreed on, and I will plan on doing a bit more work on this and hope that when it's back up next week, we'll be able to have all of the pieces we need to move the bill forward. But we don't at this time. It's my understanding that we have come a long way on the Dash 1s and made several compromises in that area. I will plan to move those. And if anyone has any input on that between now and next week, please let Emily in my office know as soon as possible. And we'll hopefully get this out again next week. So I'm going to, is there anyone here who would like to testify on 515 in light of that? I see some finger pointing, but nothing orally. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 515 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 628 and ask Lori to summarize Senate Bill 628, our mediation, foreclosure mediation bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as I review the Senate Bill 628 establishes a foreclosure mediation program, and it specifies the procedures for that mediation. It delineates the contents of required first and second notices of mediation and the procedure if the grantor fails to receive that notice. It prescribes some of the settlement procedures between a beneficiary and a grantor. It incorporates certain provisions of federal plans. It gives the Department of Consumer and Business Services certain rulemaking authority, and it defines qualified mediators and establishes some provisions related to them. It sunsets on January 2nd, 2014, declares an emergency. It's effective on passage. You should have before you -3 amendments that essentially replace the measure, and I think proponents are here to speak to, or people that requested
yes.
those amendments to run through some of the specificity there. I know there some of the changes are simply technical, and others have to do with some of the provisions connected to the Department of Consumer and Business Services and a few others they may speak to.
Thank you, Lori. And this is back again. Everyone knows that we started out with a concept. It's gone through some changes, and again, a lot of work has been put into this to get to where we are right now. And to summarize the -3 amendment, I'm going to ask Matt Wallace, are you here, to come up? And did you want to bring someone with you?
Three?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll start with Matt.
You don't have it here.
Not
today.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Don't forget to say happy birthday, Senator.
Thank you for the record. My name is Matt Wallace, consumer advocate with Osberg, and happy birthday to you, Senator Jordan.
Thank you very much.
Great. Well, firstly, of course, just thanks for the opportunity to, continue to work and weigh in support of the proposals in Senate Bill 628. I mainly wanted to get up and just walk through, some of the amendments, as Lori mentioned, a couple just technical in nature and a couple of tweaks, we think, to just ensure the efficiency and sort of streamline the policy there. But I, of course, want to just express, my thanks definitely for all the effort that's gone into getting us where we are here today, both from the sponsor, Senator Bonamici, and conversations with the stakeholders, and Angela Martin, as well from our Oregon, for putting a lot of work into coordinating these amendments that we have before us now. And then before also walking through just the specifics of the amendments, there was some interesting information, a report that came out between the last public hearing and today from the Office of Comptroller Currency and OTS looking at some of the modification programs that exist in the country, and looking at some of the successes and pitfalls and generally how they're looking and how they're working nationwide. And I've testified before this committee before that we know that unfortunately a lot of the voluntary modifications out there haven't worked as well as we might like so far, and there are some pretty high redefault rates, and that fact is borne out by this report. The good news, though, is that a lot of home retention actions are on the upswing, so whether that's a payment plan or an actual modification to the loan, we're seeing an increase in that, but unfortunately what we're not seeing is an increase in the large increase in the number of modifications that actually result in reduced monthly payments, which is a pretty key indicator into whether those modifications are going to actually succeed. So just from the report, overall for 2008, about 42% of modified loans resulted in reduced payments, which means that the rest of those loans either left the monthly payments the same or actually increased them in a number of cases. And there are a variety of reasons for that, but we know that the main reason, or the main, and one of the main indicators for whether a modification is successful is if it, of course, again, does reduce that monthly payment. And then we also know that redefault rates were consistently lower and significantly lower for modifications that actually did lower that monthly payment. Only about, for those modifications that reduced monthly payments by 10%, only about 23% of those loans became seriously delinquent later in the process. By contrast, about half of the loans that didn't reduce the monthly payment or increase the monthly payment ended up likely to be in seriously redefault later. So just a little food for thought for you, and I think it sort of lends credence to the proposal in Senate Bill 628 to encourage the use of good loan modification guidelines that help protect consumers and also make sure that we really are getting borrowers and lenders to the table with a third party to help work out the best possible scenario for folks who are in trouble on these loans. So with that, I will move on to the amendments. You have the dash threes before you. And I'll just go through section by section, explain the principal change, and then I'd be happy, of course, to answer any questions on those if you have them. First off, in response to some concerns about just sort of the consistency in the language, one thing that happened throughout, you'll see the first instance in, I think, Section 1, Subsection B, is that whenever issuance of the mediation notice is referenced, the phrase now reads served or mailed. And again, that's for consistency's sake throughout the bill. And in Section 1, there are a few other changes. One thing I did want to highlight, this actually isn't a change from the dash ones, but I think it's worth noting that the intention of the bill and the policy is to require the notice of mediation is served or mailed 30 days prior to the actual notice of sale, and the notice of sale, which really starts the that foreclosure process. So this is a change that was made in the last amendments for, I think, a couple of reasons. One, it's a way to avoid extending the foreclosure process in any significant way, and then it's also a way, I think, to avoid to allow consumers a better chance of avoiding some of the potential scam artists that exist in the industry of encouraging folks to do a short sale. We know that when that notice of default is initially, the notice of sale is initially filed, there's oftentimes a sort of a deluge of advertisements coming into consumers, encouraging them to do a variety of things, whether it's, sign up with these for-profit entities, either to try to settle that debt or negotiate a modification for the mortgage in a way that may or may not actually work, or whether it's in a way to sort of sell the house for much less than the mortgage is worth. At any rate, having the notice go out 30 days before the notice of mediation go out 30 days before the notice of sale is a way to allow that mediation process to get a head start on that particular problem. On the other change in Section 1, another change in Section 1 is that the notice will now be sent to the grantor by both first class and certified mail with return receipt requested. You can see that line 8 and 9. And this is, again, a way to just sort of help ensure good documentation and a good paper trail for the process throughout the policy proposal. And then finally, in subsection 2E, we deleted that the Department of Consumer Business Services will not be served the notice of mediation. This is a slightly more substantive change, and the idea is, again, just to streamline this process and make sure that we are, making this as efficient and keeping it among the parties where we can and not bringing agencies in where we don't have to, essentially there. So that's essentially it for Section 1. The one thing I will notice is that we did hear some concerns about whether the correct entity to or the correct document to reference in throughout the notice was actually the residential trust deed. And we maintain that in this draft because that is the residential trust deed is a document that's already referenced in an Oregon statute throughout the process. So I think that's the appropriate document to reference. No changes in Sections 2 and 3, so we'll move on to Section 4. In subsection 1, we deleted that part of the information that would be sent out would be the telephone number and other contact information for the grantor or other person named in the residential trust deed. And again, that's largely to maintain privacy concerns for the consumer throughout the mediation process, so that they're not being preyed on by potential scam artists throughout the industry, or like sort of the variety of industries, and. Also, it's clarified in subsection 6 of section 4. I'm going to make sure I do actually reference this here. That it's revised to read that the grantor, to avoid the recording of the notice of default, must actually contact that beneficiary within 30 days after the date of the notice to request mediation. Again, this is largely policy-wise the same as it is in the Dash 1 amendments, but the idea is, again, to have the borrower essentially opt into this program and request the mediation to make sure that we're not requiring a whole lot of process and a whole lot of mediations when the borrower may not actually want to pursue that process forward. Great. And then in subsection 9, we also deleted the requirement to include other contact information, and also the at least before three persons, and this is in reference to the mediators that the beneficiary will be sent, or that will be proposed for the mediation process. And the idea behind this, and actually also the change in subsection, in section 5, subsection 2, which is at the end, change with one of the remaining mediators to with the remaining mediator. The idea behind both of these changes is just to have three mediators proposed to go out in the notice, and if they both, if essentially the borrower disagrees with the one mediator on the list and the lender or beneficiary disagrees with the other, they just, you know, schedule the mediation with the remaining mediator. It avoids sort of the potential of having extra mediators on that list, which would lead to a bit of confusion if the first two were objected to by each party. And that's it for Section 5 also, actually. And then in Section 6, let me make sure this matches up. In Section 6, Subsection 4, you'll notice that the requirements for instructing the trustee to discontinue the foreclosure after a mediation or in the case where a mediation is agreed to by both parties has been extended to 5 days from 2. And then in subsection 6 of section 6, we also removed the requirement that the mediator shall report to the department and instead state the mediator that will draft said report and provide copies to the parties. And again, it's a goal to increase the efficiency of the overall process there. And in section 7, we... asked in subsection 1C, and let me make sure too that this is, that's right, just to clarify that the Department of Consumer Business Services isn't registering mediators under this process, but is rather just maintaining a list of approved mediators under the process, again with the goal of increasing and streamlining the efficiency there. And finally, in section 8, you'll find subsection 1A, there's inserted in OR at the end to clarify that that is the case. And subsection 1C of section 8 added that the beneficiary refused to accept a settlement proposal deemed feasible by means of the formula or program described in the section 2 of the bill. And in subsection 3, we revised... line 20. Oh boy, I've gotten lost in my own legislation here. Where are we? Oh, that was section 10. That's why. Section 8. Subsection 3.
Of serving the grantor with a copy of the sworn statement.
That is correct. Thank you. and then, again, the language here has changed that the trustee or beneficiary will just, again, serve or mail to the grantor a copy of that sworn statement in subsection 2. And this, again, is in those cases where the beneficiary is signing a sworn statement that one of the exemptions under the bill was met. Also make sure a copy of that goes to the grantor. So that is the pretty technical summary of the amendments. And then, you know, I'll leave it there, but of course happy to answer any questions that the committee may have on those particular pieces.
Thank you. I have a question, Matt. Do you happen to know if the Dash 3 amendment is intended to replace the Dash 1 amendment?
The Dash 3 amendment is, the rest of the language is the same. They just, it's the changes are actually fairly small, but the format is a replacement.
Thank you.
Replacement of the bill.
Needed to clarify that. Committee?
Sure.
Any questions for Matt? Nope.
Right,
thank you very much,
thanks,
Matt.
Thanks for the
for
opportunity.
For your explanation. Thank you.
Tears.
Thank you. Tom Mann, please.
Good
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Mann. I'm the Public Information Manager and Legislative Coordinator at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. First, let me apologize for coming to the party late on Senate Bill 628. Also, Senator George, wherever you may be, happy birthday, my old friend. We are neutral on this bill, but we took a look at this. You may know that the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs has a home loan program. Fairly successful. It's been in practice since 1945. And when we read this bill, we weren't sure if you meant to include a government home loan program such as ODVAs or if this was meant to look at foreclosures just in the commercial lending, not government lending. So we've been watching this bill, and we know there's been a flurry of activity. And I decided today that maybe I should come and say that the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs will be bold and request perhaps you could think about whether your intent is to include a program like the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs home loan program, and hopefully not, and exclude it from the bill. Let me tell you a little bit about our home loan program. We've done 338,000 loans since 1945, $7.6 billion in the state. We have a loan program that doesn't do subprimes. We own our own loans. We do qualified veteran mortgage bonds that we buy, and we loan that money out. Never do we sell a loan. We have it for the lifetime of the program. That's important because when a lender gets in trouble, because sometimes they do, we could work with them. We already mediate. We already negotiate. We do all sorts of things with veterans because our mission is to make sure we support veterans. So having a veteran go into foreclosure is a very, very bad thing for our agency. Not because of the financial piece, but because we support veterans and we want every veteran to have a home loan. And so we do everything we can to keep a veteran in a home. We do great underwriting. I can tell you that our delinquency rate right now is hovering 1%, and the industry is 5, 6, 7. I can tell you that our foreclosure rate is 0.63 last time I saw the numbers of a portfolio of nearly 5,000 loans. So we're doing really, really good. And our program is solid, sound. As a matter of fact, Congress just passed a bill or passed some, I don't know if it was rules or bills, last year that raised our cap. We now can loan $100 million a year in home loans. So our program is sound, safe. We do great underwriting. Our veterans are great risks for us. And we just didn't know when we looked at this bill if you really meant us or not. And so I'm here to say I sure hope you didn't. And last of all, I'll say this. I know you're working under strict deadline. I don't need to come in and throw a wrench into what you're doing. We're happy to work this in the House if you need to move this bill. But we did want to get on the record and say ODVA home loans, great product. We don't really need to be in the bill if you see it that way. That concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Mann. What happens if you have, I know you said you have a very low delinquency rate, which I hope everyone understands is part of having great underwriting.
Absolutely.
What happens when you have somebody who falls behind in his or her payments? What's the process for dealing with that person that you have now?
Well, I'm sure what we can do, because we own the loan, is we can tack those payments on the back of the loan and work with them on their finances. We can get them veteran benefits that they may not have had before, which increases their income. That can be disability benefits, pension benefits. Sometimes they run into problems because they have health care costs that are emergency costs that run them down. Well, we can get them into the VA health care system and get them free health care. So we have a lot of tools in our tool bag to work with these people, especially this fact since we own the loan, we can bump their payments.
Right, and I'm sure that the fact that you own the loan wasn't lost on us either in
yes.
terms of giving advantages to the consumers who do need to reach you when they're having problems. Are there any questions sure. for Mr. Mann? And I know a lot of the advocates are in the room and heard your testimony,
Absolutely.
So this bill is not moving today.
Okay,
so we
outstanding. Thank continue. You very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next on the list, we have Mike, is it Schnee? I hope I pronounced that correctly.
It's actually Schnee.
Schnee. Sorry. You
wouldn't think it by looking at it.
Welcome.
Chair Bonamici and committee members, I'm kind of new to this, so help me through this.
That's all right.
my name is Mike Schnee. I'm a mediator from Corvallis, and I'm president of the Oregon Mediation Association. Our usual legislative sort of a person is busy today, and this bill came to our attention relatively recently. And I just had a couple comments that we'd like to share with you. The Oregon Mediation Association is a nonprofit organization with about 300 members in the state, and essentially we're devoted to the development, support, and advocacy for mediation. And we do think that the set of issues that you're dealing with here, these complex, not really easy to solve issues, are really good ones for a mediation process. A couple of items, and we're here to support the bill. We would like to offer a couple of suggestions as it continues to evolve. The first being that of in Section 6, where you're describing the qualifications for mediators. And I apologize, I forgot to mention, I do have written testimony and I have brought extra copies.
Terrific, so thank you. Ann can pick that up for you. And Mr. Mann, when you say Section 6, are you referring to the Dash 3 amendment? Is that what you're looking at?
No, I'm afraid I didn't have.
We can follow along. Okay.
So I guess what this refers to, and was the most recent version before your amendments were done. Okay?
That's fine, thank you.
And this is the section, though, that talks about the qualifications for a mediator. There were a couple of things clearly that you were looking for, it appeared. One certainly was that the person have some expertise in the FDIC formula. And so it makes sense to us as a mediation organization that, in this case, subject expertise makes sense. So your language in there looked good for must be trained in the use of automated loan modification formula. However, the second piece, when we're thinking of qualifications, we would suggest thinking broadly about the possible mediators who you might also include. And when you're thinking whether they might be a member of the bar or a member of the housing council group or another professional mediator, that they all essentially be treated the same in terms of qualifications. Don't feel any need to draw out to, if you will, distinguish if they're a member of the bar or the counseling piece, as long as they're doing mediation. And the mediation side of this is pretty well defined in ORS 36.110, which are the mediation statutes for confidentiality. And there they do define mediator and mediation, and you might consider using that as a way of defining that. If you do it in that fashion, you'll have a very broad group of mediators to choose from with a variety of different skills. However, it will still give you the subject expertise that you feel you'd like to have. The second piece I wanted to offer up has to do with fees, and we would suggest that as this continues forward, as we talk about fees, we should suggest that fees be market-based and that hours shouldn't be prescribed. We do feel that the Oregon Mediation Association does have a set of a code of standards for mediators, and in those standards they talk about the range and variety of mediator approaches that are used. I'm sure that as you develop a list of mediators, you're going to get a variety of people with a variety of different approaches and a variety of different fees. And I think that by having that assortment on your list, it will allow your participants to actually give them more ability to choose amongst mediators of different types and variety. So with that, I thank you for the opportunity to comment. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I hope I was moderately clear.
You were. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, Mr. Mayor? Any questions? Thank you very much. Next, Beth Kay, please.
Good afternoon. Chair Bonamici and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to appear before you this afternoon regarding Senate Bill 628. For the record, I'm Beth Kay. I am Public Affairs Manager for the City of Portland's Bureau of Housing and Community Development, and I work closely with the city's housing commissioner, Nick Fish. This is an issue, the foreclosure issue is an issue that's gotten a great deal of attention lately. This afternoon I've prepared some written testimony trying to give you a sense of the dimension of the problem and the way we think the mediation would fit in and help to advance the public interest. So the city's Bureau of Housing and Community Development strongly supports Senate Bill 628 requiring mediation of residential foreclosures. In 2007, when other American cities were already experiencing high rates of foreclosure, Portland's rate was relatively low, not much higher than historical averages. Since then, our foreclosure rates have escalated sharply. To give you a sense of this, RealtyTrack reported only 20 foreclosures in Portland in 2007. For last year, 2008, we saw 548. That's a 2,740% increase. Back in 2006, Oregon was ranked 23rd in the nation for foreclosure filings, with one out of every 152 homeowners in trouble. Last year, 2008, the filings affected one in every 88 homeowners. That raised our ranking two notches to 21st in the nation. From December of last year to January of this year, our rate increased very sharply, 218%, placing us fifth in the nation. So what's happening? We're having a wave, really, of foreclosures now. Our analysis suggests that these filings were made primarily by households that held so-called resetting or exploding mortgages. These households were able to make payments at the initial teaser rate, but could not cover the sharply higher payments due when the rate automatically reset or adjusted by the terms of the mortgage. We expect further filings to result from the poor economy as mortgage holders find their household incomes have declined due to job loss or other income reductions. So I was asked to provide you with some background on how much mediation is used presently. And the fact is that no one maintains statistics on how many homeowners have attempted mediation with their lenders. Our understanding from our community partners is that most homeowners facing foreclosure are very reluctant to even contact their lenders. They're intimidated. First of all, many of them don't even open the envelope. It's like a radioactive envelope. It gets put on the side of the table. People who do open the envelopes are intimidated, often by the legal language, confused by the bureaucratic process, and ashamed that they cannot make their payments. In some cases, they're afraid of becoming homeless. Often this is the first time that a family will try to access public services, and they don't know how to navigate the system. Obviously, when there's no communication, there's no solution. And the city believes that Senate Bill 628 can materially alter this dynamic and improve it. Many of the distressed homeowners bought homes without having the proper education, training, or knowledge. In mediation, the mediator can engage both borrowers and lenders in constructive problem solving. This is far preferable to asking borrowers to extricate themselves from their situation without education, training, or knowledge. Currently, the city funds a variety of community organizations to offer home buyer education programs that include foreclosure prevention advice. But to date, we have not funded programs that support mediation. So we haven't funded, for example, a mediation coach or an advocate who might accompany a homeowner to a mediation. We are about to issue $250,000 request for proposals to fund some additional foreclosure prevention services, and we could potentially include mediation support in there. Senate Bill 628 would complement and multiply the value of our efforts. We have joined with, and we, the city, has joined with the Department of Consumer and Business Services for the State Department of Justice, the State Department of Housing and Community Services, the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, and other organizations to sponsor a foreclosure prevention event on May 2nd at the Memorial Coliseum in Portland. Homeowners are going to have the opportunity there to consult foreclosure counselors and to meet face-to-face with their lenders. There have been a ton of foreclosure affairs over the last few months. It seems like every federal office is sponsoring a foreclosure fair. And they've had low turnouts. And the reason they've had low turnouts is that the lenders haven't been there. And the opportunity to meet face-to-face with the lenders, we think, is going to be a big draw. We think that really makes all the difference, a chance to have the conversation. While this event is going to provide an important service to homeowners, our best estimate is we'll reach only a few hundred homeowners. And we know that it's just in one corner of the state and that foreclosure rates are extremely high in Bend and Ashland and all over. Senate Bill 628 would significantly aid our foreclosure prevention efforts as it provides a pathway to successful resolution for distressed homeowners and banks and lenders throughout the state. So I strongly urge your support of Senate Bill 628. Thank you again for the opportunity to address you this afternoon, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. Do you happen to know if others in other cities or in other states have had the type of foreclosure prevention event where they've actually had the lenders there at the event?
I do not. I do not believe that they have, because I think in part because the lenders have been uncertain about how to handle this. I think that the cascade of federal actions and the increasing clarification from the federal government about what it wants to have happen going forward has created an environment where the lenders have a better understanding of what's expected of them and are now at the table as willing partners.
Thank you. Questions?
Not sure.
Senator George?
Thank you, Beth, for coming up. And,
happy birthday.
Just got a lot of nice shirt. No, I want to focus in on one part of your testimony
sure.
that actually caught me, because it's sort of my theme a lot on this committee, which is on page 2, you say, many of these distressed homeowners bought homes without proper education, training, or knowledge. And I guess I've been constantly amazed sort of the things that come before this committee, because we seem to have at least a certain percentage of consumers out there that are completely ignorant on personal finance issues. And, of course, my advocacy is that we're trying to regulate sort of down to that denominator, and I'm trying to figure out how would you suggest that the state deal with, which is really the core problem of what we mostly deal with, which is we have consumers out there who don't even have the most basic knowledge. They're signing contracts without even the most basic knowledge of what they're signing, or the importance of the legality or the ramifications. How would you suggest we deal with that as a public policy issue?
That is really an excellent question. That's the money question. I am a proponent of starting from both ends to solve the problem. So I think we need better financial literacy education at every step in our educational process. I think it's perfectly possible to go to high school and graduate from high school and not learn how to balance a checkbook or track your withdrawals on your ATM card. I think that there are many people who don't graduate from high school, so I think waiting for high school is too late. I think we should be doing this in elementary education. It's part of math. And I think we need less of an emphasis perhaps on marketing and more of an emphasis on being smart about your money. And so I think that's very important. I also think, and I was a lawyer for 15 years before I started doing the work I do now, I think that legal documents are unnecessarily confusing. I think there's a lot of room for plain language in the law. There was a plain language movement. It was the cause du jour for a few years. It's kind of gone out of style. It should be back. I'll tell you that I went with my mother to the closing of her condo purchase when she moved out here from New York City a few years ago, and my mother went through every line of that document until she understood it, and we were at that closing for 7 hours. I thought I was going to die. However, she used what she learned growing up in Brooklyn, which is you don't sign your name to something that's going to cost you money unless you understand exactly what it means. And the documents are not written in a way that even a college-educated person can understand them. So that's what I would do. So from that end, from the financial literacy end, start early, start often, and from the other end, I think helping people who have gotten into this kind of situation is important. The piece the city is doing, the city has recognized that home, and I think many municipalities in the state have as well, that homeowner education is key and needs to be required anytime a person is thinking about owning a home and maybe getting any amount of public funding or public support
for that, whether it's in the form of a subsidy for the purchase or a soft second mortgage or something like that. You've got to go through the home buyer education. It's going to include a big piece on foreclosure prevention, how to recognize the wolf, even when the wolf is disguised as granny. And that's what we make people do.
Thank you.
Thank you. And, Beth, I saw a lot of heads nodding positively
about
when you
mother?
Talked about about financial... When you said happy birthday to Senator and about financial literacy. And there have been efforts here in the legislature and in communities throughout the state to improve and enhance financial literacy. And I saw the credit union representatives back there shaking their heads. And there are discussions ongoing in the education community about incorporating more personal finance and financial literacy in our educational system. So it's something that we're very much aware of. And we also in 2007 passed a plain language bill that I guess is beginning to take effect for our state government. But
yes.
Maybe slowly.
The volume is something. I think I've always found that kids are very interested in money. The same way kids can tell, you know, your real keys from your fake keys, they understand that money is what makes the world go around, and they want to know how to use it and how to be in charge of it. I think we'd find them very, very receptive at the young grades.
All right.
So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify about Senate Bill 628? Going on. Sybil, are you? Sybil has.
Thank you, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center in support of Senate Bill 628. And I apologize. We had expected a co-worker of ours to be able to come down today, and she had a case that needed her attention, so she wasn't able to be here. But I did just want to let the committee know briefly about the issue that she wanted to share. The woman's name is Kim Carty. I hope she'll be able to write a letter to the committee so that you'll get the benefit of her expression of this. But she's an attorney and a realtor. She represents borrowers to try to negotiate essentially what I think I understand to be short sales. And so she's working with a family in foreclosure, and they are having a great deal of difficulty, the family is, as she is, in getting through to the lender to do any kind of negotiating. This attorney has actually found a buyer for the home that will offer, they feel, a much superior price for the home than would be available through foreclosure, and they simply can't make them aware of that and can't get any response. And so she's worried that as the date of the foreclosure sale approaches, she's going to lose her ability to sell the home and to prevent the foreclosure in a way that would benefit both the borrower and the lender more than the foreclosure would. And so I think that's just something to keep in mind. That's one of the reasons that our office is interested in this bill. So I just appreciate your attention, and hopefully you can get more details via letter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions for Sybil? Thank you very much. Anyone else testify on Senate Bill 628 today? Come on up.
Senator Bonamici.
Welcome.
Dave Fennell again.
Hi, Dave.
Still with the bad throat. I just wanted to say briefly that I've looked at Dash 3 just very briefly just here, there are some significant issues. I did send out comments, I believe, to the committee, and I apologize if that breached protocol. But I'm hoping that we can still work with the group to get through these.
Thank you very much. I know that you have been in communication with the proponents of the bill, and the advocates have taken your comments into consideration, and I know we'll continue to do so. So
great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 628 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 640. Lori, will you please summarize the Senate Bill 640?
I would be happy to, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 640 was before you on the 24th of March, I think. The bill is introduced. Requires real estate broker applicants to have high school diploma or GED certificates. It requires them to complete certain educational courses required by the real estate agency. It establishes some continuing education criteria for licensees, and it prescribes some rules for the continuing education providers and the teachers and the courses. There are Dash 2 amendments that I just received, bless you, I'll just briefly summarize some of the provisions in there, and then I believe that the representatives from the Oregon Association of Realtors and the Real Estate Agency will also speak to those. The Dash 2s allow a real estate broker applicant to show proof of an international equivalent of their high school diploma, or what we would call a GED. It specifies certain continuing education provisions that apply to the renewal of an active license. It revises some of the provisions relating to the rulemaking of the real estate agency and the implementation of those rules. It provides some additional prescriptions for continuing education and the certification of instructors. And I think one of the substantive changes probably summary of some of the substantive changes is that it changes some of the resource requirements for the real estate agency. And I think folks will speak to that.
Thank you so much. And we have Jean Bentley, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, Senator George, happy birthday. I'm Gene Bentley with the Real Estate Agency. Interestingly enough, the Real Estate Agency, being the first real estate agency in the nation, just celebrated its 90th birthday. So I'm sure Senator George
is a lot older
than you. He'll be
85.
I'll try and summarize very briefly the written testimony that you have before you and let you get out of here so that you can go party for your birthday. The real estate agency has been working with the Oregon Association of Realtors, and I think we've got everything sorted out. I'm going to address the Dash 2 amendments. Basically, the Dash 2 amendments require applicants for a real estate broker license or a property manager license to have a high school diploma or its equivalent. It requires that the applicant for a principal broker license pass a agency examination. It requires that amendments to changes to continuing ed process and the licensing renewal establish rules for the providers of the education, establishes the qualifications for the education instructors, sets rules for course topics and learning objectives. It sets a new requirement which will require that the course changes in law be a specialized course. Typically, it's going to be about a three-hour course, which will provide the individual licensees with an opportunity to find out what's recently changed in the law or rule so that they're up to speed with what's current. It sets up a situation where the provider must ensure that each course they offer is eligible for continuing education credit and that the instructors meet the statutory requirements. All of that goes into effect on January 1st of 2011, which allows us enough time to be able to go through the rule-making process so that we can get this up to and running. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Committee members, do you have any questions? Do you happen to know Mr. Bentley, or maybe we need Jan up here to confirm that the Dash 2 amendments replace the Dash 1 amendments?
That's my understanding, but I'll let Janet talk.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Janet Jarvis for the Oregon Association of Realtors. Yes, the Dash 2s have some small technical changes from the Dash 1s. There were a couple of, we wordsmithed a couple of sections here. We added an active licensee when we were talking so that we weren't referencing continuing ed requirements for licensees who have their, or people who have their licenses on an inactive status, and a couple of other small wordsmith sort of changes. And so the Dash 2s would completely, the Dash 2s are what we would like to see you move forward today.
Thank you. Any questions, committee? Any questions? All right. I'm going to close the public hearing. Is there anyone else who's here to testify before I do that? I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 640 and open a work session on Senate Bill 640.
Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 640, dated March 23, 2009, were adopted.
Senator George moves that we reconsider the vote on the Dash 1 amendments. Any discussion? Any objection? Do we If not, okay. Seeing none, no objection, then the motion carries, and the measure is once again before the committee in its original form.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 640.
Senator George moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 640. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? If not, the Dash 2 amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 640 to the floor as amended with the Dash 2 amendments dated 4609 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 640 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm always concerned, and I say this every time we do some of these additional educations, I am always concerned about industries putting additional barriers to entry for competition. And I've reviewed these amendments, and I view them as acceptable, but I also want to just constantly warn that we do have industry groups that want to create barriers for people competing with them. I don't necessarily think that a person without a high school diploma or GED is somehow incompetent. I've met many people who have neither a high school diploma nor a GED or some of the smartest people I've ever met in my life. And so I'm a little reluctant to do this. However, I think that the advocates have made their point, and I just want to constantly reiterate, we need to be looking out for the consumer and not necessarily for the industry, and I think this particular bill does that. So that I'll be voting yes on the bill.
Thank you very much, Senator. Any other comments? Seeing none, Ann, will you please call the roll?
Senator Burton?
Aye.
Senator Girard?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 640, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. This is the Senate President's bill, and I will ask him to carry it. And if he doesn't, Senator Burdick, would you carry this bill?
Madam Chair.
If the sponsor declines, thank you. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 640. And I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 377 and ask Lori to do a summary for us, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 377 has to do with insurance re-rating. If the consumer requests that re-rating when they are renewing an insurance policy, you have a Dash 5 amendment before you, and some of the provisions there, it allows the consumer to request that annual re-rating if the insurer uses that credit history or an insurance score at any time in the rating of the personal insurance policy. It requires the insurer to apply the same standards as they used when the consumer initially applied. It replaces the 10-day period that was in the introduced bill with a 30-day period for re-rating, and it indicates that if a consumer qualifies for a more favorable rate, it requires the insurer to reduce the premiums on the policies for which the insurer uses that credit rating. And then it has some provisions having to do with the difference applied. It also changes the renewal reference to the 60 days of renewal if the improved rate is less than $10, and it provides for the return of the unearned premium if the policy is canceled or not renewed. The fiscal and the revenue, minimum fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Thank you, Lori. And you can tell from the meeting dates, this has been up several times, and as the chief sponsor of the bill, I have been working with various groups and made several changes from its original form. We started out with a 10-day period and ended up with a 30-day period, and then we also included at the request of some of the industry the ability to, if it's less than $10, to provide as a credit upon renewal. If the policy is canceled or not renewed, then the insurer shall refund the unearned premium. So we tried to accommodate the comments that were made based on all the testimony that we had on this bill. So any questions? Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chair. It's been brought to my attention. I think there's a one-word mistake in this bill, in the amendment, and that is on line 10, the way it is written, that if they re-rate, then all insurances that the consumer has would be have to be re-rated. And so if you change the word any to the, that would be the intent of the bill. And so I would encourage that we make a one-word wordsmith change here, and my vote will hinge on that.
Thank you, Senator Girard. I'm at the point where this bill has been up so many times, and it's my understanding that this particular version of the amendment was shown to people in the industry before it was drafted, and if it came back different from the version that was viewed by the industry, I am committed to talking with whomever on the House side would get this to make sure that that change is made. But I do believe that we've made many, many attempts to change this to address the concerns of the industry, and would commit to, if that in fact was not what was agreed upon, then I would commit to changing that as the next step.
Madam Chair, the problem is that by asking for a re-rating on an automobile insurance, you might, by the way that this is written, you could be impacting someone's homeowner's insurance. And so I don't think that's your intent. I just think that it'd be a very simple thing to amend the amendment right now for the one word.
Well, we can't do that in the committee, though. Yeah, and then we'd have to get a new fiscal, and it would have to be...
The fiscal is not going to change by changing...
Input from the other committee members about whether they...
Madam Chair, I know you've worked a lot with all the parties on this, and as a person who was heavily involved in the initial compromise in the 2003 session, mm-hmm. I was very pleased with how this bill was amended to keep faith with that initial agreement between the industry and insurance holders. I don't think that this is worth holding the bill up. I think if we get it to the other side and it needs to be narrowed down, I just think it's had so many eyes scouring it that I'm comfortable with it the way it is, and I would be happy to vote for it today.
Thank you. And if I could just direct you to the next sentence, that it says, if the consumer qualifies for a more favorable rating category, the insurer shall reduce the premiums on all personal insurance policies the consumer holds for which the insurer uses the consumer's credit history or insurance score to determine rates. So I think that sentence clarifies the intent of the bill. So,
and Madam Chair, if I could add, we just never heard an issue on this regarding homeowners insurance. But I would think that if it's certainly in keeping with the bill, if they are using this for homeowners insurance, that the issues are no different. That you would, you'd want to make sure that any increases were based on claims experience, and if your credit rating, upon renewal, which is the agreement we reached in 2003, but also that this bill, if there is a material change in the credit rating, that I think the issues would be the same.
Thank you. And I again reiterate that I believe the following sentence clarifies the intent, that it is for the policies on which the insurer has used the consumer's credit history to determine rates. So. All right.
I would entertain a motion.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which the -3 amendments dated March 20th, 2009 were adopted.
Senator Rosenbaum moves to reconsider the vote by which the committee adopted the -3 amendments dated March 20th, 2009. Is there any discussion? No discussion? Seeing none, is there objection to the motion? If not, the motion carries and the measure is once again before the committee in its original form.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -5 amendments to Senate Bill 377.
Senator Rosenbaum moves to adopt the -5 amendments to Senate Bill 377. Is there any discussion? If not, the amendments are adopted.
Oh, sorry. Madam Chair.
Senator Rosenbaum.
I
I move Senate Bill 377 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Rosenbaum moves Senate Bill 377 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Durst.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to compliment the Chair on working so hard on this piece of legislation, and I know that you've spent a lot of time personally on this and included me in discussions, and so this is more of a vote explanation. I just come to the conclusion on this particular bill that there are preferred business practices that we want businesses to do, and I applaud all those businesses and those insurance companies that actually do it the way that we have here in this bill. I'm just not sure that I've been convinced that this is a public policy decision that the state should mandate on businesses, because some businesses are doing it, some are not, and it's a competition. And we heard that one of the insurers that we felt wasn't doing it correct in 377 is actually doing a great job when it comes to dealing with claims in another arena. And so this is part of the idea that businesses provide different services to their customers and consumers, and it provides a little bit of flexibility to differentiate yourself. And so at this point, although I think you've done a great job, and I think it's good business practice, and I encourage all insurance companies to do this, I'm just not sure it raises to the threshold that I think that it's a public policy decision we make at the state legislative level, and so I'll be voting no, but I applaud your efforts on the bill.
Thank you, Senator. And I believe, as we discussed previously, as Senator Burdick mentioned, we have, as a legislature, before my time, and I believe it was 2003 or 2005, passed legislation that does deal with the use of credit in insurance. And because that policy is in our statutes, I believe that the policy in Senate Bill 377 is to implement the previously enacted legislation fairly to all consumers in the state. So with that, Ann, can we please have a roll call vote?
Senator Burns?
Aye.
Senator Jobs?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair
George?
No.
Aye. Senate Bill 377 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I will carry this bill. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 377 and open a work session on Senate Bill 771. Lori?
Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 771 came before you on the 19th of March last, and you may recall that this is a bill that is the culmination of work by a coalition of landlord and tenant advocates. There are -2 amendments before you, and they are hot off the presses, and the members of the coalition will be here to speak to those specifically and answer questions, I think, if you have them. However, let me summarize in connection to some of the tenancy issues that were referenced in the bill as introduced that are changing here or that are revised. It revises, again, that temporary occupancy provision. These are the -2 amendments to which I refer. It revises some of the personal property provisions relating to deceased tenants. It clarifies a provision relating to the no-cause termination of tenancy, revises some provisions relating to fees and charges that occur on or after the effective date of this particular measure, makes some other additional technical revisions. You have a no revenue impact and a no fiscal impact of the dais before you.
Thank you, Lori. And to testify on...
It's actually a work session.
I would like to have an explanation of the -2 amendment. So I think John Van Lanningham is here, and I can ask him to come up and explain the -2 amendments, please.
Thank you, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. John Van Lanningham, Lane County Legal Aid. So the -2 amendments really only make 2 substantive changes to the concepts that I described in my testimony in the public hearing on March 29th. So rather than, it makes a lot of small changes that are probably of interest only to nerds who are really, really, really into this, such as whether we have to have the phrase at any time in this line. The coalition drafts its coalition compromise bills word for word, line by line. We give them to legislative council, and then we fight with legislative council to get it the way we want it. And so that's what most of its, the -2 is about. The 2 substantive changes reflect negotiations with Department of State Lands over the abandoned property of a dead tenant, and Division of Department of State Lands wanted, and we agreed that the abandoned property notice will go not just to the rental unit and the heir and the personal representative and an individual designated by the person who died, but also to DSL. And DSL is sort of the consumer protection advocate for unclaimed property, and that would allow DSL in that case to know that the property has been abandoned, go to the unit, and make sure that it gets to the heir or the right person. The second change is to say that in that queue of people, the lowest ranking category is the designated person. In other words, in many cases, a landlord will have a tenant at the beginning of the tenancy say, if you die, give me the name of somebody that I can contact for your stuff. That's a designated person. And if there is no heir, there is no personal representative, the stuff is not worth a lot of money, nobody's fighting for it, then the designated person goes last, after the heir, after the personal representative, after DSL. If none of those three people claim it, then the last to claim it would be the designated person. Those are the substantive changes in the Dash 2s.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
I'm sure there's one thing I also wanted to say before Senator George jumps on me.
happy birthday.
There is another change. There is another change which we have committed to make on the House side, and that addresses an issue that's been raised. It was raised in testimony before you by a Salem realtor named John Baker. It was raised in Senator George's questions, I think, of me at the hearing. It's been raised by OAR in the interim, and that is that the 60-day notice this bill provides for in a no-cause notice of not 30 days, but 60 days. Current law is month-to-month tenancy. Either side can give the other side 30 days no-cause notice at any time. There's that phrase, any time, that I don't want to lose. But what we've done with the bill is say that after the first year of occupancy, the landlord can't use a no-cause notice unless it's at least 60 days. And that's to reflect the, for longer-term tenants, it's hard. It's a hardship to move, find a new school, find a new place, etc. So the realtor concern is that if you have a home that's in sale, they don't want to evict the tenant before sale. We don't want them to evict the tenant either. It may be that the buyer wants to move in. So they would like to have the shorter 30-day notice instead of the new 60-day notice. It's a fairly limited situation. We don't particularly like the idea as tenant advocates, but at the same time, we recognize it's a pretty limited situation. And if it's a pretty limited situation, why not? And we stole this idea from California, and California has that exemption. So I don't have any really good arguments against it, and we're willing to make that compromise, and I've made the commitment to make that change working with OAR, but we want to do it on the House side because we're worried about getting it done right. I expect it will take us a couple of weeks to get it done right, I don't think we have a couple of weeks to get out of the Senate.
I'm glad you clarified that there was a timing issue and you said you want to make sure it got done right, so you wanted to do it over there. We would take it personally.
If I could, John, I just want to tell you how much I appreciate the advocates of the bill being flexible with me. I know you guys spend hours and hours negotiating these things, but I really do appreciate it, and I'll be supporting the bill. And I appreciate your efforts.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So I will entertain a motion.
We didn't have any previous amendments, right?
Correct.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 771 dated 4709.
Senator George moves that we adopt the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 771. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 771 are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 771 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves 771 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Anne, can we please have a roll call vote for Senator George?
Aye.
Senator George?
Yes.
Senator Rosenthal?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 771 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do I have a volunteer to carry this bill? Senator Rosenthal?
Sure.
That wasn't exactly a volunteer. Thank you. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 771. Yeah, no, it's okay.
the dais. They had a big problem.
I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 772. And ask Lori to please summarize.
Do you have anything? You want me to summarize it?
Yeah, please.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senate Bill 772 has to do with landlords, some issues dealing with landlords in service billing methods and utility billing methods. You've had this bill before you, on March 26th and April 7th, coming before you again because there were some issues about fiscal, the fiscal statement. Would you like me to summarize the substance of the bill or simply reference the fiscal issue?
We've done that. We carried it over from the prior hearing because or work session because we had some questions about the fiscal, and maybe what we can do is have Lori go ahead and tell us a little bit about that while John brings in Senator George's birthday cake.
I would be happy to do. Should I speak slowly as it's all set up for Senator George, who happens to be having a birthday today? Okay. The fiscal that was recently issued on the 7th of April does indicate that there is some impact in implementing some of the provisions, although it is not an impact that has any it doesn't impact the general fund. So there was there have been some conversations in trying to in clarifying that fiscal, I guess I would say, and there's those conversations are ongoing.
Right. So just an update, committee, we do have the a revised or an amended fiscal impact statement just from the agency, but we don't have LFO's analysis of that in light of some new information that's been provided to them. So I think this is again on the agenda, or we're not going to carry it over. We're going to post it again for next week so that when we get that revised fiscal impact, we will bring it back again. So I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 772. And is there any more any comments or anything other than...
Happy birthday.
I'm more singing.
I was wondering if this was going to be another demonstration of the Troy cigarette lighter.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not sure that we have a lighter.